I'm here in the County Hall in Talla, and I'm talking to Tomás Maher.
Yeah.
Tomás, tell me a little bit. You're born in 1950.
Yeah.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cabra, on the other side of the city, north side.
And would your parents be Dublin or?
Yeah, well, they were Dublin with country background, so all my grandparents were country.
What part?
Well, on my father's side, and I didn't know my grandparents on his side at all. They were gone before I came along. His father was from Tipperary, of course, Mar being a Tipperary name, and he was from down Ross, around Ross Cray, the heartland of the Mars, you could say. His mother was from Wexford. So I went on holidays regularly to Curraclough, Wexford, where his mother came from, and kind of got to know some of the cousins and that down around there. But that's the extent of my knowledge on my father's side of the family. I knew his sisters and brother as well, and they lived down around Ringsend, Irishtown area.
What did your father do?
He was a bread salesman with Johnston Mooney and O'Brien, and he drove when I was a small kid, he drove one of the horse and vans, you know, delivering bread around the city. And of course they were all changed to electric vans about 1962, early 60s anyway.
A very old, well-established bread.
They were one of the biggest bakeries in Dublin. They were beside Herbert Park, you could say, beside the Dollar Bridge there in Paul's Bridge, and they had a huge stretch of land there, stables and all out the back, and people ran on many horses. They had probably had about 50 or 60 horses.
And how many years did your father work with them?
He worked with them from the time he was 14. Because he was the eldest in the family, and he actually, when he was 14, he had to go out and support the other children in the family, you know. So I suppose he would have had a fairly poor background that way. His own father worked on the railways. I think that's what brought him to Dublin. But his father died, I think, when he was fairly young, and his mother married again. And his mother had died by the time I came along, a couple of years before I came along. Irishtown, Ringsend, that area, I suppose most of it would have been fairly poor back in those days, and that's where he grew up, you know. Would have been real dope.
What are your earliest memories? I mean, growing up there, where do you remember the smell of bakery, the, you know, I mean, what were the things that kind of stood out in your mind?
Going to the bakery, us over. Yes. I have one brother, so he's a year and a half older than me, and my dad would bring us over occasionally. And you would get a strong smell of bread baking in the bakery, and he'd show us all that. He was always very proud to show us that, show us how the ovens worked and the travel ovens, how the bread went through them. It took an hour or something to go through them, you know. And all the loaves come out the other end, you know, and then he'd bring us out back to where the stables were and show us his horse, you know. As far as I know, the horse he had when he brought us over there was a white horse, I think.
Had a name?
Can't remember that. I know it had a name. They all would have had a name, you know. The thing about the horse vans was, and I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of them, they didn't have much cover from the elements. They had a little lip on the top that kept a bit of the rain off the driver. But other than that, they were open to the elements, you know. So the electric vans would have been a step forward in comfort.
But your dad would have often got a soaking, so.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And as well as that, when I was small, like up, I'd say, till around 1960, well, maybe not quite 1960. He used a cycle to work when I was very small, which was about from Cabra, would have been a good probably 4 or 5 miles, 5 miles probably there and 5 miles back. And then as he got older, he invested in a small Austin, and he drove the Austin over there. But unfortunately, I'd say with driving the car, he got less exercise, and he ended up dying quite young of a heart attack when he was 51. That's when I was about 20, thereabouts.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And was there a big family of
No, just myself and my brother.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And my mother just passed away there about 9 years ago. So,
where did your love for Irish come from?
My love for Irish, well, the language, yeah. My granddad, first of all, because he had a little Irish. Now, my mother says he learned it in classes in Dublin. He was quite Republican in his outlook, not extremely so, but like he would have been Republican, whereas her mother, that's my mother's father I'm talking about, they lived, my granddad and grandmother on my mother's side, owned the house that I grew up in.
What was your mother's maiden name?
Gibney.
Gibney.
So Gibney is an old castle name, you know, it's from Westmead. And Westmead would have been, Old Castle would, from what I've read, was about the last stronghold of the Irish language in County Westmead, well into the late 19th century. So I reckon he heard Irish as a child growing up in the 1880s.
Passed it on to you then?
Passed a bit on to me. He mightn't have had it fluently. He just had a few words, like he'd say to my brother and myself, now say Gormahakut, you know, Mashidale and things like that, you know. But it was his whole being, his whole personality that was came out of that old tradition. Yeah. And so he would have had a lot of Irish in his English, in the English he spoke. His accent would have been a real kind of Cavan Westmead accent as well. So I would put it back to, on a deep level, I would put my love of Irish back to him and the influence he had on me. Mm-hmm. Of course, my father working long hours as a bread man, and as I say, travelling by bike over there when I was young, he wouldn't have been in the house as often as my granddad was when I was small. So my granddad and grandmother had quite a strong influence on me.
And what about your schooling? Christian Brothers?
Yeah, Christian Brothers. First of all, went to Stanhope Street, which was a nun's school in the junior classes, which was about a little over a mile distance away. We used to walk there and back, across by the Cattle Yard and North Circle Road and down into Stanhope Street. And first year I went to school, I remember the first day I went to school, I cried all day. Sure, I wasn't the first one to do that. But the first year I had a lovely teacher, Miss Laurie, I always remember her name because she was kind and gentle.
Yeah.
But the second year I had a targer altogether. I won't mention her name.
And you remember that, right?
Yeah. The second year, the teacher I had for the next couple of years, she wrapped a knuckle selfie with her stick, you know, but she wasn't at all like the gentle person I had the first year, you know.
Yeah.
But from there, you could only stay in that school till you were 7. So you had to go on then to more senior school. And my mother, she wanted to get us a good education. Now, the school across the road was probably good, but we were a bit snobbish. So my mother wanted us to go down the road to the Christian Brothers, you know. So she had a bit of influence there because my grandfather's, I think my granddad had passed away at this stage or he was ill, but his one of his cousins from Cavan, where his family had moved, you see, into Cavan at the time of the land wars. So they'd gotten a bit of land beside Loch Sheelan, which was a bit away from Oldcastle. They'd been evicted from there during the land wars and they had to put everything they had on a cart and travel to the Loch Sheelan area where somehow or other they got a bit of land there and settled down there. But one of his, either his acquaintance or one of his cousins, Reynolds was his name, he was the caretaker of St. Canice's School, which is on the North Circular Road. Now, St. Canice's is no longer a school. It was run by the Christian Brothers and it was kind of the free school which was taught by the same group of brothers as O'Connell's schools, but O'Connell's was a fee-paying school at that time. So we were in no position to pay fees. And my mother, through her influence, family influence, got us into St. Canice's and was a top-class school. They had some very good brothers. Some, of course, were a little bit mad, wrapped in uncle's coffee again, you know, or did letters that time, you know. But
But you got through it
I got
quite
through it,
quickly.
and overall, actually, some of the teachers were actually very good, and they gave me somehow the love of Irish, and of actually using it went in there, as I say, the first influence from my granddad. But I remember in sixth class in primary, during Irish classes, that something clicked, that my understanding of the language, actually communicating through it, something actually clicked. And when I went into secondary, then I went to O'Connell Secondary. The first year I didn't have a good Irish teacher, so there wasn't much progress in that line there. But the second and third year, then doing junior cert classes, I had a teacher from Limerick, an Bráthnaid O'Flynn, who was a magnificent teacher on every level. He taught, not only did he teach Irish a fantastic manner, he taught English. He didn't teach us French. He taught some other classes French, all right, but not us. But he was a fabulous teacher. Just.
Did you think about putting your Irish then to use? I mean, did you think of teaching at any stage or?
No, I never did actually, because I think I lost confidence then going into leaving cert classes, and I ended up with the one honour in it in Irish, and
Everything else.
everything else went a bit down the tubes at that stage. The maths, I lost. I used to be a genius at maths in junior cert classes, and then never caught up then with calculus and all this kind of stuff you did at more senior level. And I think even the teacher we had didn't understand it properly himself, even possibly.
When you left school then, had you any idea where you were going to go? I mean, had you a plan or did you just want to get a job, you know?
I think it was really just get a job when I came out of school. I used to do a little bit of retail work in a jeweler's during the summer holidays when I was in school. Murphy Jewellers, they used to be under the Metropole, which is where, what shop is there now? Penny's. It used to be BHS beside the GPO on O'Connell
Oh,
Street.
yes.
And there used to be a lovely jeweler shop there. Of course, that was a magnificent building. The Metropole building was an absolute gem of a building. Which was knocked down, for a more modern, plain, minimalist facade. But yeah, I worked there during summer holidays. So I think when I left school, I got a little bit of work with them that summer. But of course, then the summer work went, and I went into retail work. I eventually ended up working in a bookshop in Hannah's in Nassau Street, and Hannah's, they were one of the old Protestant firms of Dublin. A lot of the old firms in Dublin at that time were either Catholic or they were Protestant. If they were Protestant and you weren't on the right side, you got so far in the firm and you didn't go any further. And the same way, perhaps, with some of the Catholic firms, maybe not as rigid as that, but that began to disappear fairly rapidly in the 1970s then.
But could you see a future in the jewelry shop or were you?
Not really. I have to say now that for me, part of my makeup somehow or other wasn't that I was looking in any great way towards the future. I was just content to dawdle along,
Yes. But were you thinking, I mean, were you thinking of Johnson, Mooney and O'Brien or were you thinking of?
No, I wouldn't. I think I would never go near that kind of work. Like when I saw the kind of hard work my dad had to do, and I suppose he kind of inculcated that into us as well, that we should never do that kind of poorly paid work,
Is that why you looked at the public sector as something
Well, I'm
interesting
only in
and
the public
secure?
sector now 7, almost 8 years, you see.
All right, so between that and the time you came out of the jewelry shop, what were you
That is a
doing?
good many years
Yeah.
and a good many jobs in
So
between,
you took quite a few jobs up along the line.
I did indeed, yeah. And I'll just give. I suppose there has been a common thread, really, of the Irish language down through a lot of things that I've followed. Because when I left school, I I didn't, you see, when I went again, when I went to the leaving cert classes, I'd left on Brother offline behind. He was junior cert, and but he had given me this ability to actually think in the language. He'd encouraged that we could go to debates, Gaelic debates at that time, inter-school debates, and of course we'd go out to other schools, girls' schools and fellows' schools and different places and debate all kinds of subjects through the language. So it began to foster that kind of ability to think in the language and debate subjects seriously in it. Now, when I went to leaving cert classes, I didn't have a good Irish teacher. So even though I got an honour in it in the leaving cert, I hadn't developed my ability in it all that much during those 2 years. But when I left school, I thought about a year after leaving school of trying to do the leaving again and getting three honours in it and going on to university. So I began to study the leaving cert again. And of course, I was going to study Irish again because that'd be one of the honours that I'd surely get. And at that time on the curriculum, they had Mickey McGowan's Rochamore an Taoil. Rochamore an Taoil, of course, Mickey didn't write this book. It was taken down on tape from him and written by somebody else because he couldn't write very much anyway.
I know, but a ghostwriter wrote it all down.
Yeah. And of course, he'd spent time in the Klondike and he gives a good account of life in Donegal and how he was went to the hiring fairs and all the rest in the late 1800s and that. Well, actually, he would have been a child in the mid 1800s, probably. But reading Mickey McGowan reminded me of my grandfather because I could see the same culture, the same person, in the same kind of personality to some extent. I could feel that from reading it, you know. And so it was an encouragement to immerse myself, immerse my mind to some extent back in the language. And okay, the ambition of doing the whole leaving cert again and getting three honours fell by the wayside, but
Yes.
I did make contact with him brought her offline again because he was actually teaching in the Deaf and Dumb School, Declan's actually, which was a Christian Brothers school attached to the Deaf and Dumb up in Cabra, which was quite close to where I lived. And I made contact with him again. Now, he advised me to go to Cunar na Gaeilge. It's the first time. I'd never thought of going to the Gaeltacht or, you know, there was no question of going to a college in the Gaeltacht or Antrim at that time. But I'd never set foot in the Gaeltacht at this stage. But he encouraged me to go to Cunar na Gaeilge. So I went over to Harcourt Street and at that time in the basement where Club Cunar na Gaeilge is now, there was a branch that met every Thursday, I think it was, Craigmore V. And Craigmore V was a very lively kind of branch. You had a lot of young people in it, around my own age that time, around 19, 20. And some of them were from the Gaeltacht. Some of them had grown up in Dublin speaking Irish, such as Eamon O'Caoimh and his brother Breon. There were people like Seamus O'Matthew, who has written lots of books on local history, and I think he teaches local history now. Colm McShelley, who sang with Nifireen, a musical group, and Gearóid O'Murchú, who sang in the same group with him. There were some older people then who used to come along and enjoy the young people's company. There used to be ceilidhs every now and then, and there was also a walking club attached to it called na Fánaithe. They had a little hostel or a little hut with bunks in it up in Ballynockan, and we used to go there once a month, and every other week we'd go out walking, speaking Irish all the time. You know, we were real fanatics and radicals all together, you know. But anyway, the outcome of all that was, as I say, I did work in Hannah's for not quite a year, I think, as a shop assistant there. It was all right work and I got on well enough with them. And there was a bit of a dispute that somebody came in and tried to start a union in the place, which wasn't looked upon favourably at all. And partly because I was friendly with the guy who tried to start a union, he was sacked, by the way. And
Right.
because I was friendly with him, I was looked upon with disfavor for a bit, you know. So when I started to kick up about toilet facilities, I was given a week's pay in lieu of notice. And with that week's pay, I funded a week's holiday in Rossmuck. And
so you were going to head off down, do you?
Yeah, so I think that was the second time I had set foot in the Gaeltacht. A few months before that, I had gone to, I think it was the first Oireachtas na Gael, which was the first Oireachtas held in the Gaeltacht. And that was in Kilchearán, out near Carna Way.
Yeah.
And that impressed me very, very much, spending even a weekend with people in an Irish-speaking area with a family.
Very good.
And going
yeah.
to the activities of the Oireachtas and that. At that time in Kilchearán, you had people like Seosamh Ó Cuaig. You might know Joe Cook, and been one of the anchormen on the morning news on Radio na Gaeltacht for a long, long time now. Barbara Ní Cheannamh, and her sister, I think, might be that lady Tresa Ní Cheannamh, who's been in the news lately to do with Egypt, might be connected. It might be her sister, I'm not sure. But they were all young people around my own age at the time, and they were quite radical. They were very involved in Cearta Sibhialta na Gaeltachta, which had just started up at that time.
Yeah.
One of the other people who was active out of that, around that area at that time, was Des Fennell and Jasoon.
Yes, indeed. And did this kind of follow a pattern in that the people who were involved were of a certain age and came from certain families, or were they just a widespread of all kinds of local people?
You mean
here in the city?
Here in the city,
yeah.
The people in the city, in the club, were, as I say, few of them from the Gaeltacht, from Connemara, and a couple of them from Kerry, and then the majority would have been from around the city. There would have been people who had learned Irish, you know, or a couple of them like the O'Queeves, who had been brought up Irish speaking, you know. But as I say, Rossmuck, when I went out there after leaving Hannah's, was the second time I'd spent time in the Gaeltacht. And I actually spent a week in Kilvrican, which was near Pierce's cottage out there, just where you enter Rossmuck, you know.
Yeah, so did that give you inspiration then to maybe go on and do something
to
restore the language and to promote the language and that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was what would be called a fanatic at that stage. But, I liked Rossmuck, and I liked the week I spent there. It was very leisurely. I loved the people I stayed with. Can't quite remember their name now, just at the moment, but they lived near the crossroads in Kilvrican, and got to know the life out there a little bit more. The next stage on that was then Kalash Dinevian, Danny Lovely and people like that. They ran adult courses. They had just started them up, I think, at that time in the summer college. And I think it was the following summer I went to spend 3 weeks on an adult course in the college. So that was more time in the Gaeltacht.
And what college was this now?
It was Kalash Dinevian.
And that was where exactly?
That was held in one of the schools in Rossmuck during
yes.
the summer months.
Yes.
Yeah, the national school in Rossmuck, as far as I can remember, would have been down kind of this around the village area.
So this went on for how many years did this go?
Well, I'd say the culmination of this stage of accustoming myself to Irish and acclimatizing to the Gaeltacht would have been a year after that, when I was still going, when I come back to Dublin, was still going to Craigmore V, when I met an older gentleman from Fermanagh, Padraig McGillarooy. He's still alive. I never realised the difference in years between him and me till very recently. He is now, I think, 83 this year. He lives in Belfast. And I hadn't seen him actually for years till there last October, since the time I lived in Connemara in the 70s. And hadn't seen him in between. We had a bit of a falling out, but went back up to see him there last October. And he lives up in Lorgan, I think, comes into the Coulterland there in on the Falls Road fairly regularly. But Padraig was another stage of another teacher, really, in a sense, because he had a fantastic knowledge of the language, like almost like you might say a professor, but was more like a tramp in his way of life, you know. That he was giving me care and maybe suited me in a way that he washed dishes in a hotel at that time. He had a little flat somewhere, and I'd go up to the flat occasionally for to learn more from him. And at one stage, I was kind of maybe falling out of love with Craig Mulvey at this stage, and maybe with the language movement that was. I needed to go a little bit beyond.
What year was this?
This was about 72.
And Radio na Gaeltacht was very much on the
Radio na
go.
Gaeltacht started, I think, a year before this, but
Before,
maybe 70 or 71.
yeah.
So that was a big influence as well. Also, around that time, you had Ó-Riada and Ó-Riada's influence on the music and the incredible surge of creativity which came through what Ó-Riada was communicating, you know. This looking back into the songs and re-establishing the songs in their own right of the old tradition, like the real tradition of the language, you know, that people like me coming from the city began to get a taste of this culture, which was so kind of ancient and had a different kind of ethos about it than what I grew, a lot of what I grew up in, you know. Again, it would hark back to my granddad and what he gave me on a maybe a subconscious level or something, you know.
But you were really now, were you at this stage very immersed in the revival of the language and promote and again
yeah, I would have been, and I suppose in ways like for me, I would have always been trying to work out in. Intellectually, you know, why, what was the justification for reviving this language? You know, you had all these, you know, the nationalistic justifications and this, that, and the other, you know. I could never come to a whole conclusion on this myself, and I don't feel or think about the language in those terms at all. It, to me, it began to be a thing of feeling. And that's how I ended up. Along with Padraig, going to live in Connemara, because Padraig said to me one day, he said, "Look, we all this debating that goes on about this, that, and the other. Why don't we just go and live where people speak the language as their normal everyday means of communication, you know?" And that's what we actually did on a shoestring. I had a job, yeah. Can't remember what the work was at the time, but I had a little few bob put aside. It wasn't a lot, but I bought some camping gear and cooking gear. He put a couple of bob into the kitty, and off we went hitchhiking over to Galway.
Well, and the two of you then, I suppose in your mid late twenties,
Well, I
right?
say I would have been 22 then,
Or were you,
and
is it?
he, which I didn't realise then, probably would have been his late 40s, you know.
Yes.
So that's what we did. We went out there camping, went camping in places maybe that a lot of Connemara people wouldn't set foot in, out in the hills and out the back of Cairn and up around Lynchgan and Renville, up all up around that area, you know. Come back down then round the back through Dhearcháil and down around Rossmoke, and we ended up in a little isolated spot called Seanfhéistín, which is up from Rossaville in the hills between Rossaville and Uachtaráid.
Were you living a real kind of hermit's type of
A
lifestyle?
hermit's or a hippie type life, yeah. We had these grand ideas of forming a kibbutz out in But of course, that never materialized. You know, Connemara people weren't the least bit interested in anything like that. But what came out of it on a practical level was, yeah, we settled down in a field beside this farmer who had a large young family, Padraig O'Dougain, and his wife, Nancy, I think was her name, in Shanna Feistein. It's near Fermoy Lodge, and we got to know the people around the place. Padraig welcomed us very much. He allowed us use his field for camping in for the latter half of the summer. It was the whole summer we went out there, you see, and we spent about three months tramping around. But halfway through those 3 months, we settled down in Padraig's place. I think we camped 6 weeks in his field, and he would give us dinner every day. We'd give him a hand with bringing in the hay and bringing in the turf and things like that. Of course, it was very hard physical work, which I wasn't used to at all, you know.
Yes.
But we enjoyed that, and it was a great way of getting to know people.
But this couldn't have lasted very long.
No, and it didn't, because, of course, when September came in, the evenings began to get quite cool, and you couldn't practically stay in a tent for much longer. So I went down. I suppose Padraig was very much a lot more a dreamer in a sense than me. And I had a practical side to me at the end of everything. So I went down. I had a little old crock of a bike, which I think I brought over from my mother's house at some stage or other during the summer. And I cycled down around Cushardiga. And I ended up going to Johnny Colwyke, Sean O'Cushtala, you might have heard of him. He died there a year and a half ago. He was a great community playwright and poet, and he lived in Tully near Balnahown, near where TJ Carr is now. Mm-hmm. And Johnny had a chalet which he rented out in the summer to Nafamari, the visitors coming for the summer. And I went in to talk to him, and I managed to get the chalet for the winter months, for the whole winter, often for £4 a week.
Well, that was okay.
Yeah, it was. Well, I mean, £4 was a bit of money then, yep. But I mean, it wasn't outrageous, and it was quite feasible. So what I did at this stage was I went back to Dublin, and we had this grand idea of starting a bookshop, because one of the things we noticed was that the literature in Irish wasn't generally available to the people who spoke the language on an everyday basis. I know Tomás McGowan and Brendan O'Hare had done work of travelling around in a van for Cogan na Siúnta na Gaeilge, but there was no permanent place where you could access books in the language, in the Gaeltacht. So I had some contacts with Cogan na Siúnta na Gaeilge. I managed to get a couple of hundred books from them on sale or return. So we started this business on absolutely no capital whatsoever.
Imagine that. And how did you manage to buy stock then?
Well, this was saying I got 200 books on sale or return.
All right. And so that kind of got you started.
That got me started. When I then made contact with Saoirse Le Gaisdill, who were about the biggest independent publishers at that time, and they gave me another few hundred books, and also after a few weeks they gave me a small grant of £250, which was a substantial sum at that time. They wanted me to buy a little car, but I didn't drive. Yeah. I'd gotten a bit scared off of driving earlier on in my teens, but I bought a motorcycle, a Honda 50 with a big box on the back of it. And you see, first of all, I used to go, the bookshop only operated as a base, the chalet. You wouldn't really get many people calling in. After all, it wasn't in a town, it wasn't in a village with streets or anything like that. We're out in the middle of the countryside. Housing is a bit denser in Connemara, but it's not that dense, so you wouldn't get lots of people calling in to you. But I used to go around on the push bike, first of all, to people who I knew were interested in books. Some people would tell me, oh, so-and-so down the road there would love to see the books you have or whatever. There were lots of new kiddies books come out that time, beautifully illustrated. And Lima Gisbrydin books, there were translations of French publications with beautiful pictures in them. Mm-hmm. They sold at about 40 pence that time.
Yeah.
And there was a great demand for those. So I got quite a few of those and sold quite a few of them out there, and some adult books as well. When I got the motorbike, I was able to go further afield. So I would operate between Barna and Carna, basically, and got to know people, got to stay with different people, got to stay in Dasun Fennel's place, which house he built out in Weenish. And at that time, he lived out there with his wife, who was a teacher in Carna Community School at that time, Mary. And That's what I did for basically for a year till the following summer.
And you must have enjoyed those years though, or that particular time, because you were doing what you wanted to do. You were involved in the selling of Irish books and in the language. But when it all came to an end then, and you had to seriously think of the future, what did you do then?
I kept that bookshop going for about 11 months, I think. Maybe not quite that, 9 or 10 months. It came to the point where things changed for me. As I said, it was kind of a feeling that drew me out there in the first place. I liked being in the countryside. I liked being off away from the city, getting a change from city life. And I liked using the language, thinking in it, being immersed in this culture, which had somewhat of a different flavor off of it. And after practically a year of all that, I met somebody in Galway who told me about a young Indian man who was teaching people something very, very simple, to feel a, how would you say, a really beautiful feeling. I don't know how to describe it, but it struck me as what I had been looking for. And I went back. The first time I heard about this meant nothing to me. I wasn't interested in anything Indian whatsoever. Never was. The second time this chap met me in Shop Street, he used to have a sandwich board there with pictures of this young lad who had come from India, and he was known as Miraji at that time. And this chap John, he was a Galwegian, he used to play his guitar half the day down there when he'd have time off work. He'd go down Shop Street, play his guitar. He'd have this sandwich board with pictures and little quotations on it. And if somebody stopped to talk to him, he'd tell them about this lad Meraji. So that's what happened to me. I listened to him one day. As I say, I said, "Tat, I'm not really interested in anything Indian." But 6 weeks later, I met him again. And something had happened to me where something rang a bell, and I went to listen to young people talking about this chap. And I suppose that, in a sense, changed course for me because I no longer, after that, focused kind of so much just on the language. I felt that the language had drawn me in a certain direction, but what I really was looking for, I had already, and I just needed somebody to show me how to access
Describe that. I mean, what was it?
it. Essentially, a feeling, which I felt when I sat down and listened to the young people talking about their own experience, because they had already learned techniques from this young man from India. And when they spoke about it, they communicated this feeling. And it really, that's basically what it was, communicating a feeling, not a philosophy.
Was this a religion,
No, no.
or was it a kind of a way of communicating with people? It was just another form, or was it a particular form of communication?
What the young man from India himself called it, he called it knowledge and self-knowledge. Beyond that, it could only be communicated by the people who had learned how to practice it. And it was communicated essentially, if you sat down in a room listening to these people, and you listened carefully and you really had a thirst in you, which I had, because I say that's what drew me to Connemara and drew me looking for that feeling. The feeling came to you. You felt it, and you wanted to learn this thing yourself. And that's what happened. I just kept listening and hung around these people more till I eventually got to a point where a teacher appointed by this young lad came and taught me the techniques. And I followed that up since. And as I say, it changed course for me because I was no longer focused on thinking that what I really needed was contained in Irish,
Yeah.
you know.
But what benefits? What did it do for you?
What did it do for me? Well, that's a long story, really, and I think it's a life story. I think I'd need to come and talk to you again sometime
All
about
right. But are you practicing this now?
I am, yeah.
All right. So this is something, this is an Indian culture thing, and you have learned the techniques and you're now practicing and
Yeah.
teaching these techniques.
I don't teach them, no. And again, it isn't really Indian culture, because what I learned, and really it was a journey from the time I heard about this till my understanding of it now. Because yes, a lot of people had the inclination to turn it into religion, because they were brought up in religion, and it was their whole way of thinking. But it never worked that way. And the chap who taught it, he's now 50. I went to his birthday party there a while ago. Prem Rawat, he uses his family name now, whereas I say at that time he was known as Miraji, which was a title was given him in India. But his family name, he has a family now himself, his own family has grown up, and he's known as Prem Rawat.
But finally, I mean, looking back now in just those years, you're now here in Tallaght County Council. Are you're working
I work in the
in the
libraries.
libraries?
Yeah, I work a half week with the libraries, and
Yeah.
I've been on that contract now for nearly 8 years.
But you're going to continue doing this research and this work that you got yourself that you all those years ago fell into, you know.
Yeah, you mean with Miraji and
Yes.
that? Oh, yeah, I love that, and I love actually letting people know about it because I think it's such a good feeling. That I like communicating it to other people. It actually does me a lot of benefit. But my other work in that, well, you see, in the other half of the week, outside my library work, I work as a library assistant. I say I've been over 7 years of that now. The other half of my week, I spend doing heritage work with schools under Heritage Council scheme. Teaching some Irish to adults part of the year, and doing some work with the arts department in the council sometimes as well, freelance, that kind of thing. So I've quite a variety of work in
So
hand.
you really have a full day, a full your time is totally taken up with work at the moment.
Well, to a fair extent. I mean, I give a lot of time at home as well. Like my
Are you
kids
married
anyway. I am
to
married. I
family?
have three
Yes.
girls. Yeah, I'm married now, 20, nearly 30 years. My eldest girl is 30. And I've two others, 10, 27 and 25. One of them lives at home still. So yeah, no, I do spend quite a bit of time at home, and I do some work at home. Like I have a little office there now. One of the girls has moved out, but I would say coming back to what you were saying, like when we were talking at the beginning there, like that, I didn't have any great aim, career-wise. I hadn't got my sights set on a particular thing, a particular career, and I'm actually only in public service now 7.5 years. But I couldn't, when I look at it, what I do now and the variety of work I do, I couldn't ask for a better career layout than what I have, because it joins together an awful lot of threads in my life, and I feel whole in a sense that I could have never imagined.
Yeah, well, it's a fantastic story, I must say, Tomás Maher. Although I feel that I should come back and listen to more of your learnings associated with this Indian culture, as or not, as you say, it isn't a culture, but
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Indian.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm sure, hopefully, I would like to come back. at some stage if it was convenient. It's just that this evening I'm stuck for time.
Thanks, Tomás, very much indeed.
Thank you, Morris.